This is London Calling.
Welcome to the show. I'm Graham Mack and a couple of good guests for you in this one. We got the singer Kim Wilde and also the composer Jeff Wayne. That's coming up. Hope you've had a good time recently. I've had an awkward time. My identity got stolen. My credit card got cloned and I've had all kinds of trouble with it. Pretty sure it happened when I stayed in a hotel in Stevenage in Hertfordshire. And this has happened to you as well, Vince.
Credit cards.
Yes, I've been stung.
And bank fraud.
Yeah.
Well, it's happened twice to me, to be honest. Credit card wasn't quite so bad, but it got cloned in a hotel in Bournemouth.
Now this is where I think mine was done, only in Stevenage. I think mine was done in a hotel, yeah.
Yeah, it's the only place it could have been done, but they were caught trying to buy some gear on the net, but because I'd got a safety code, which they didn't know, it flagged up.
Right, okay.
But the biggest one was my bank. I had one of these, I've still got it, one of these accounts where your mortgage and everything was included, and you could borrow off of your mortgage. It was quite easy to borrow. You could just go on and transfer money from part of the account.
Right.
It was a really good account, I'll be honest with you. A fantastic interest rate.
Yeah.
People had died for my interest rate.
Yeah.
Anyway, I came home on Friday, and I it was before I used to have my account on my phone. I went onto the internet, and I thought, hang on a minute, it's £15,000. It was on a minus.
£15,000? Yeah.
£15,000.
Yeah.
£15,000. And this was like 4 o'clock or 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock on a Friday. And I'm thinking, £15,000? What the hell's going on?
Yeah.
So I thought, you can't phone your bank up. You can only phone a main, like, source.
Yeah.
So I phoned the guy up and he went, oh yes, I can see what happened. The money came out in, Hoddesdon. I went, no, it didn't. I said, I haven't taken the money out. This is what you can't seem to grasp. I haven't taken the money out. Somebody else has.
Yeah.
Excuse me. And he said, no, I'm pretty certain we've got CTV of your wife taking the money out. I went, well, I doubt that very much because she doesn't even know about that account. So, and I said, plus she's at work. So anyway, he said, he gave me a number of Hoddesdon Bank, said, you got to phone it.
Right.
Anyway, I phoned the bank, no answer. Left the message. I thought they're bound to get back to me. You know, I've told them that I'm.
Yeah, £15,000. Yeah.
Down. You expect somebody to get back to you, don't you?
Yeah.
Well, all Saturday. In fact, I phoned again Saturday morning. I know the bank's open. It's open all day Saturday. Never ever phoned. Never answered their phone. Never phoned me back. Trying and trying. Anyway, come Monday morning, I'd had enough. So I phoned the bank fraud squad.
Yeah.
Who said to me, we're going to have to close down all your accounts.
Right.
I said, all right, fair enough, I understand, which they did. Didn't hear anything during the day until about, I know what time it was, around 5 o'clock on Monday night.
Yeah.
The manager of Hoddesdon Bank phones me up.
Yeah.
And says, oh, I've just heard your message on the phone. I went, just heard my message. What, the message I left Friday night, Saturday, Sunday? I said, you've just phoned me back. Yeah, well, what's the problem? I went, the problem? You've taken £15,000 out of my bank. That's what the problem is.
Yeah.
And she went, really? And I went, yeah. I said, and I can assure you, it's not me. It's not my wife. It's nobody I know. So where's my £15,000? She went, oh, I'll get back to you. We were here half an hour. She's back on the phone. Oh, yeah, well, we've sorted it out. It's it seemed to be some sort of internal problem. Thinking, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Anyway, next day, the money was back in my account.
Right. So it was easy to fix, but they couldn't fix it.
It was easy to fix.
Yeah.
I still couldn't get back onto my... I couldn't log in to my account still.
Yeah.
So I phoned up the fraud squad. No, the fraud squad phoned me on the Tuesday.
Now, is this the fraud squad? Is this the police or the fraud squad from the bank?
No, this is the bank.
Yeah.
Is the bank.
Yeah.
And they said, right, we're still looking into it. I went, what do you mean you're still looking into it? The bank sorted it. They sorted it yesterday. And they went, well, they haven't told us.
Oh,
and
what?
I thought, really? I said, I can't get into my accounts. And they went, well, we'll have to try and sort it out. I said, I'll tell you what, I've got her, she gave me her number. I gave it to her, gave it to them. I said, phone her on this number, which they did, and they got straight back to me, and they went, no, she got back to me, and she went, oh, Mr. Taylor, yes, we've sorted out your bank, and the money's gone in, and also your accounts will be open online from now. And I'm thinking, thank you.
But what about as a gesture of goodwill, is a couple of hundred quid for your inconvenience? What about that?
No, the gesture of goodwill was they charged me interest for the 4 days.
Bonzi.
About a year ago, I noticed my wife's card had been stolen and cloned.
Yeah.
I never reported it because I spent less than she did.
Get off! I'm Graham Mack, and this part of today's show proudly sponsored by Bagpipes. Yes, Bagpipes. Providing irritation for over 1,000 years. A lot of people think the bagpipes are Scottish. They were actually invented by the ancient Egyptians, who sold them to the Scots as a joke. Scots still haven't got that joke. The first of my two guests in this episode is the singer Kim Wilde. And Kim, you've got a new album out. It's called Here Come the Aliens. And it's called that because you had a close encounter.
So there I was, sitting in the garden, looking up into a Hertfordshire sky. And these, actually, you know what happened first, Graham, was that some helicopters came over from a direction they never come in, and quite low in a way they never normally do, with a bright light surrounding them. And I just presumed they were on the run, you know, looking for a wrong'un.
Well, I thought. So you thought it was the police? It was the cops.
I thought it was the cops. You know, I thought that's what it was. So I was sat in the garden waiting for some wrong'un to come running up the garden, and then they disappeared, and it was completely silent, dusk, still a bit of sun at the back of, you know, into the west, and a bit of low cloud into the direction I was looking, and that's when I saw the light, and I saw the light literally. And I was with a mate of mine and my husband, and we walked down to look at it. And then it started doing this really astonishing stuff where, because I couldn't see it, I could just see the light it was making through low cloud. And then it went from.
So what did it look like? What shape was it?
It was a circular light. It was a glowing light, like you would see, if you saw the sun through cloud or a moon through cloud. Except that it suddenly started moving really rapidly, like with a blink of an eye, from say about an 11 o'clock position to about a 2. And then back to 11, then back to 2, then back to 11. Then a smaller one started following it. So then it was started being like two somethings were doing something with bright lights up in the sky. I could definitely see it wasn't anything coming from Nebworth House, you know, because I thought maybe they were having a bit of a party and getting the lights out. But I knew it wasn't them. I checked up to make sure there was an event that night. There wasn't. Just because I was so completely flabbergasted by what I saw. But I did meet people locally who saw also something, actually saw it, in fact. I didn't see it. I saw the light it made, but I did see people, I did meet people who saw something very strange that night. That was in 2009, the 26th of June, by the way. Anyone out there who's saying, yeah, I was there, I saw that, Kim. I saw it.
So, you're convinced it was aliens?
I'm convinced it was aliens. I'm convinced that they've been visiting this planet for many, many thousands upon thousands of years, that they're probably resident in some part of our planet at some, or have been at some point, or are. I don't know. I haven't been in contact with them, so I haven't got a clue what they're thinking. I don't have any special insight into their psyche, but I know what I saw. And I also felt whatever was up in the sky was massive. So I'm not talking like a little Chinese lantern. Or
what, are we talking like, when you say massive, are we talking the size of a car or the size of a building?
A building. Or bigger. Yeah. It was massive. Whatever it was up there was massive.
Yeah.
I could feel almost the air being displaced around me when I was standing on the grass. And I said that to my friend at the time. I said, try and think of a word before this stops. Think of a word to help describe this. And we both said momentum, because at the moment it moved from 11 o'clock to 2 o'clock, we felt the whole place move. It is like it displaced all the air. It was massive, you know. Yeah. Ha ha! Hertfordshire, good old Hertfordshire. So as a result, I went off and you know, totally stunned, and I've ended up making an album called Here Come the Aliens.
Because that's a line in one of the songs, isn't it?
It is. The first song, 1969, I talk about my astonishment of being an eight-year-old watching man land on the moon. And I remember it vividly, sitting on the sofa, watching the black and white TV, and seeing man land on the moon and being completely blown away. I'd only known about the man in the moon from my fairy tale books up to that point. So seeing a human being on the moon, just, I never really recovered from that. And then, of course, the aliens turned up in 2009. And so the song was born. 1969.
I gotta say, I love the cover.
Thank
you. I love the cover. It looks, you're on it, and you look like a horrified B-movie victim in the poster for a B-movie.
That's right.
What was the inspiration? That was it, was it?
That's what we wanted to do, yeah. I spoke to, well, Scarlett, my niece, did it, actually.
Yeah.
And she's been studying art for the last few years. I mean, she's a sort of a slightly more mature student. She's in her late 20s and discovered she had a talent for drawing. And she's been studying art in Australia for the last few years. And I thought, you know, well, you're an artist. You're in the family. But why don't you do it? And it was only after, as I was walking away, thinking, oh God, what if it's horrible? What if I don't like it? What am I going to say? What am I going to say to my own niece? Like, oh, actually, it's not really nice, is it? But anyway, I thought, I'm sure she'll do a great job. I knew she had a lot of talent, and wow, she really smashed it.
It looks great.
She smashed it. She's done an incredible job. The artwork on the booklet on the inside of the CD is also extra and astonishing. And then she's done even more artwork for the Candy Crush project. And
yeah.
She's, you know, she's just, you can't stop her. And she's on tour with me. So, you know, she's just on fire.
It really is a family affair. Ricky's on tour with you, as usual.
Of course, yeah. I mean, he wrote and co-wrote and produced, and it's, you know, the whole album. And he's the MD of the band, and he is, you know, he plays anything. He's a musical genius. I'm not overstating it there. He really is quite exceptionally talented. And I've always known it, and a lot of people have always known it, but now the whole world really knows about it, especially that beautiful voice of his in Pop Don't Stop.
Yeah,
you know,
which was the first single from the album, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Pop Don't Stop, the first single, and Ricky's singing on it, and what a lovely voice he has.
The current single's called Candy Crush.
Candy Crush.
Tell me about that one.
I went over to, Sweden is the sort of home of pop music, really, and I decided to go over there and do some songwriting with some brilliant writers. And I'd written with them before. We came up with Candy Crush. I wanted to write a song that was a bit like a Billy Idol song. I thought, you know, I want to write the sort of song that he might sing. And it's
got that 80s vibe, that early 80s vibe to it, though.
And it's very rocky as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, it's very rocky.
And it's got a lot of attitude. And in fact, on the album version, it's got three guitar solos, which, you know, you can never have enough. Never have enough. And, and it's come out sounding great. Yeah. It's, I noticed when I was on tour, I tour a lot with my band, and there are a lot of them do play that game a lot. Candy Crush.
Okay, on the phones, yeah.
I don't play games on phones.
Right.
I don't much care for phones. I don't mind Twitter, though. I like Twitter. That's fun. The head of Candy Crush just got in touch with me. And he loves the song, and he wants to meet me, and it's a hilarious turn of events. God knows what's going to end up now.
Oh, well, that's good. Well, that could turn into something like a marketing campaign or something. You never know.
You never know.
There could be money there.
Yeah, I'm kind of like thinking, wow, where's this going to take us? But I love the song. It's one of the rockiest songs on the album.
And this is the first album of new stuff for, what, 20 years?
Well, you know what? I have recorded a few albums over in Germany, of which I'm really proud. So there's a few that came out sort of in the mid-2000s and somethings. And I work a lot from out of Germany. And I ended up having a big hit over there with Nena of 99 Red Balloons fame, which actually went to number one virtually all over Europe. So I did do more recording over there. It's sort of in the same vein as Here Come the Aliens, really.
Yeah.
But just not quite as accomplished as this album. This album's been a lot longer in the making. It started in 2014. I wrote 1969, several years after the UFO sighting. So I wrote it in 2014. And we've been writing ever since 2014 till just recently when we put the album together.
Right, because the last one we probably know before is the Christmas one.
The last last one would be the Christmas one, yeah.
Yeah, because we were playing that on in a run up to that. What was 20? Was it 2014? Is that about the year right then?
I think it was.
Ooh, yeah, because it was after the. Well, yeah. it was a couple of years after you'd been filmed on the train.
That's the one. That's the one. That inspired me to get my act together and celebrate Christmas in a slightly altogether more respectable way.
You would tell us about that. Now this is 2012. Somebody videos you on the train singing. You become a YouTube sensation. I think it's over 2.5 million hits now.
Yep.
So you were coming. You were leaving a party. You were with Ricky.
Yeah, yeah. And then we did the party, and there were free cocktails flying around. And then I nicked somebody's antlers, and then we ended up at King's Cross. I don't remember much after that. I do remember. I don't even know how we got on the train.
So this is the train from King's Cross to Nebworth, is it?
Yes.
Yeah.
And then Rick was about to put his guitar away, and I said, come on, Rick, it's Christmas. Let's sing some Christmas songs. And I remember him looking at me saying, are you sure? And I said, come on. I said, when are we ever going to be out on the lash and have a guitar with us and it be Christmas? I said, come on, the stars have lined up. The planets have lined up where it's meant to be. Meant to be. So out he gets his guitar. We start singing these Christmas songs. In my sort of over a fresh state, I just assumed everyone would join in.
It took a little while to get them going, didn't it?
There was hardly anyone joined in.
At one stage, there's a lady going, it's actually her. Yeah. See, up until then, they just thought it was some woman on a train, crazy lady on a train. And then, no, it's Kim Wilde singing Kids in America. It's not. And then you did... What was the Christmas one?
Rocking Around the
Christmas Tree, which is the one you'd done with Mel Smith for Comedy Relief.
It got filmed by this really sweet lady called Casey Eames, and we actually got to know her after, and she was very sweet and phoned us up and said, do you mind if I put this on YouTube?
Oh, that's nice.
So, but I think she's done quite well out of it.
Has she?
I think she has. And then we did a new version of Rocking Around the Christmas Tree for my Christmas album, Wild Winter Songbook. And we invited her onto our video.
So, oh, lovely.
So she turned up on our video and we were filming her, filming us. So it was quite fun. It's a nice little twist there. But yeah. Actually, right after the sort of drunken episode, when Ricky and I decided that sitting down was a better idea than falling over, we met this gorgeous family who were coming back from Winter Wonderland, and we ended up singing Little Donkey with the kids. And we did try 12 Days of Christmas, but then we got really confused after about 11.
Right, okay.
I mean, it's a confusing song.
There's lots
to sing
of leaping.
When you're sober and when you're over refreshed. The 12 Days of Christmas is very, very tricky.
Now, do you still drink?
I don't.
Is it because of that incident?
Maybe partly. I mean, I'm not sure. I've been thinking about stopping drinking for a long time. All the coolest people in rock and roll don't drink. Mm-hmm. I did a tour with Alice Cooper. He didn't drink. He's cool. And a lot of the rockers have had to stop their drinking ways.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I was, I like to have a drink, but I did have to think about, you know, maybe carrying on, like getting drunk sometimes isn't such a good idea.
Was there a particular incident or anything like that? I asked that question because I don't drink anymore. I packed, 1998, and it was because I was just doing breakfast radio, and there was a day I needed to get more work done, and so instead of having a sleep in the day, I didn't have a sleep, so I didn't have a drink because I'd have a drink with lunch.
Yeah,
and then I stopped, and I thought, I got loads done today, and then I thought, oh, I can't remember the last time I went a day without a drink. So I'll see if I can go a week. And I did a week and felt great. But whenever you tell someone you don't drink, they all think, oh, we must have had there must have been an incident.
No. Well, what happened was I did Stoptober.
Did you?
And I felt really good.
Last
October gone.
It's weird how great you feel, isn't it? And how you can just do more stuff and you've got more time to do stuff and you feel good all day. And
exactly.
Yeah.
So I did that. Felt great. Physically felt a lot better. And dropped some weight.
Right,
don't mind that. and I thought, you know what? This is really good. I'll keep it. I know I'll have a few drinks at Christmas and I'll really enjoy those. And then I got to Christmas and I really wasn't in the mood for it. And so now we are in March and some of my drinking buddies say, oh, you're so boring. Kim, you're so boring. And actually, you know, there's nothing boring about this at all. It's just the best I've felt, and I've got so much done. And certainly when I knew the tour was coming up in April, I thought it's a no-brainer.
Yeah.
And I feel so much better. If anyone's thinking about it out there, do it. It's so cool.
Yeah. And as you said, a lot of cool people, you know, people like Frank Skinner and, you know, just load, not just rock and rollers, but, you know, yeah, really cool people.
People who want to get stuff done.
Yeah.
You know, drinking doesn't help. It's people who want to get stuff done.
Yeah.
I got a lot of stuff I want to get done.
Well, you've done a lot of stuff, though. I mean, you're an award-winning gardener, a best-selling author. I mean, at one time, you kind of, when you got into the gardening, you turned your back on show business, didn't you? A little bit.
I did, totally. Not a little bit.
Oh, really? The gardening was all-consuming then?
Yeah, no. When I met my husband, within a very short period of time, I just stepped massively out of the business that I was in, the music business. I dyed my hair brown when I was having our daughter, Rose.
Change your name?
I changed my name to Fowler, mm-hmm. Which is an anagram of flower. and I kind of waltzed off to the horticultural college in Enfield, you know, Capel Manor. And I just had an open mind about life. I loved having a blank canvas. I loved not being Kim Wilde. I loved the idea that I wasn't going to have to travel around singing Kids in America anymore. I'd done that since I was 20. I was 36. I was so over Kim Wilde, massively, really bored, and I wasn't having any fun. And then I met my husband, and we started to have a lot of fun. And
where'd you meet him, by the way?
I met him at in the musical Tommy in the West End, which was a decision I made to try as a sort of a halfway house out of the music business and into somewhere else that yeah. wasn't the music business. And although I was singing rock and roll songs every night for a year, there's the music business world is very different to the theatre world. And so it was a proper halfway house for me. And within 6 months, I'd met and married Hal. And now Hal's
your co-star who was in the show, yeah?
He was a co-star in the show. He was Cousin Kevin and I was Mrs. Walker. And now, nearly 22 years later, we have a 20-year-old son, Harry, who's a musician, beautiful guitarist. And our daughter, Rose, who's 18, she's a singer-songwriter. And Hal is very involved locally. He's chair at Waste Not Want Not, the recycled plant volunteer community project down at the Roebuck. He's massively involved with that. We're growing plants for them all the time, growing plants with them, working with the people there, and having a really, really lovely time there.
And the kids, what did they think about Mum going back on the road at your age?
Oh, you know what? I played the album to my daughter. Do you know what? I wasn't actually able to listen to my album properly until download day, which was when it was released.
Really?
Because I'd been sent mixes on various emails and various attachments. You know how finicky all that stuff is? And trying to put them all in one place and listen to them. I mean, it's beyond me on a technical level.
Right.
And so I actually hadn't round or had an opportunity to listen to my album properly, you know, in the running with the running order as it is until it was available for everybody else. So I actually got to hear my album the first time that everybody else did. And so I played it to my daughter a week or so ago when she was in the car. She just loves it. She goes, "Mum, they're bangers, Mum, bangers."
Well, that's a good result.
I think bangers is a good word.
Yes. Yes. Use it as on the slogan for the album. They're bangers, Mum.
Yeah.
Here come the aliens. Kim Wilde. It should all be part of the marketing campaign.
Yeah.
And what about your son, though? Because he's more of a rocker, isn't he?
He's a rocker, yeah.
Well, what does he think of pop, then?
I think he's a bit sniffy about pop music at the moment. Although I think he's coming round. I do. I think he's coming around. Actually, I've got no worries about Harry Fowler because he loves Joni Mitchell. And any 20-year-old that loves Joni Mitchell is okay, isn't it? It's everything. The world is fine.
Yeah. Yeah.
All is right with the world.
It's like the next generation then of the Wilds, isn't it? Because how much help was it for you that your dad was Marty Wilde?
Well, in many ways, massively, because, of course, I grew up listening to incredible music because he was Marty Wilde. He was singing at home and writing songs all the time, playing guitar in the living room all the time. It just was as natural as getting up and having your cornflakes and a cup of tea to see Dad sitting there writing songs and invent and making music the centre of our universe, really. So some families have sport, some families have religion. We had rock and roll. And so he would always go out, he'd be buying loads of vinyl, he'd bring back the best records. You know, he got sat down listening to Bookends by Simon and Garfunkel and Pet Sounds by Beach Boys and any number of amazing albums by the Beatles and all their solo projects, not to mention Tchaikovsky and Elvis Presley. And we had the whole lot. We had access all the time to his record player. He didn't give us, you know, the lecture about don't you touch that. So we felt very involved with music. And then, of course, later, when my career began, he co-wrote Kids in America with my brother Rick. Getting into the business was purely one of those luck things where Rick took some other demos up to London, touted them around, and met Mickey Most. And my introduction into the music industry was really through Ricky, because of his talent and because he had got Mickey Most really excited about working with Ricky.
Now, had Mickey Most, I mean, Mickey Most, legendary record producer, worked with The Animals, worked with Susie Quattro.
Yeah, he discovered Susie Quattro.
Yeah. Did Mickey hear Kids in America? Or was that before?
No, this is a good story. So what happened was Ricky turned up at RAC. Mickey Most was very interested in Ricky as a young 18-year-old. He could see.
Because Ricky was going to be the guy, wasn't he? He was going to be the next musician, not you.
Well, Ricky, at that point, was doing demos locally around here in near Hartford. I was doing backing vocals. And when Rick said he'd got a lot of interest from Mickey Most at RAC Records, I thought, right, I'm going to row myself in as a backing vocalist. And that's sort of what all I really wanted to do. Yeah. I didn't have delusions of grandeur. I didn't fancy going in and being discovered which is what happened. But what I wanted was a job. You know, I thought, well, I can sing. I know how to do harmonies. I would love that job. That's a great job. I'll have that job. So when Rick got to RAC, I said, can I come and just hang around? So I did. And Mickey got Rick in to do some recording. Kids in America hadn't been written. When Mickey met me, he just thought I looked like a proper old pop star.
But tell us the Kim Wilde he met. Did you look like the Kim Wilde that we know from Kids in America video?
Yeah, I just spent like a year at Foundation, Art Foundation in St. Albans, and I just dyed my hair blonde, kind of a combination. I wanted to have a mullet a bit like Linda McCartney, uh-huh. and I wanted to have blonde hair like Deborah Harry.
Right.
So I went to, what was it called? Hair Now or something. Anyways, one Wellington City with those two pictures, a picture of Linda McCartney and Debbie Harry, and came out sort of looking very bright indeed, scaring the horses and everything. And then, I had my secondhand clothes on from the charity shop. So this was kind of that punky, funky look of mine, and walked in looking like that. And Mickey Most thought, wow, she looks like a great pop star. I think this could be really exciting. Can she sing? He asked Ricky, can she sing? He's like, what do you mean, can she sing? She's great. So at that point, Mickey Most, I think, kind of had me eyed me up and had an idea to work with Nicky Chinn and Mike Chapman,
yeah.
who at that point were writing all the hits for Susie and
yeah.
endless other
Sweet.
Artists and Sweet. And also, Smokey and Hot
yeah.
Chocolate and a whole bunch of huge hits that they had written, especially for Susie, though, the brilliant ones for Susie. So that was Mickey's plan. I think he thought, great, let's get Kim in with the boys and we'll get her off and running. And when he said that, Ricky thought, oh, no, you don't. She's my sister. If anyone's going to write a hit for my sister, it's going to be me. So he went home and he wrote Kids in America. And he recorded it in Hertfordshire. He recorded the whole thing down at Heath Lodge in Hertford with the Enid, who are the prog band, the Enid.
Yeah.
Chris North, their drummer, drummed on Kids in America. The rest of the instrumentation was done purely by Ricky.
Yeah.
He put down the whole backing track at Heath Lodge in Hartford. And then my dad went down, listened to it, and came up with the lyrics for Kids in America. I went in a few days later, did the vocals. We took it to Mickey, And the rest is history.
So was that the demo, or was that what actually ended up on the record?
It's what ended up on the record.
Really? The one that was done in Hertfordshire? So The Kids in America was recorded here?
Yes, it was.
Look at that. And how about America?
It's one of the many reasons I love this place.
Had you ever been to America at that stage?
No.
So you're singing We're the Kids in America, you'd never been to America?
Yeah. And it kind of sounded better than We're the Kids in Hertfordshire. It was just one of those things. I can't tell you how many times I wished I had been American. It would have made things so much easier.
Well, then your career then just took off. It was amazing. You hold the record for being the most charted British solo female act of the 80s with 17 UK top 40 hits. And this doesn't even include what you were doing in Europe, because in Germany and Scandinavia, they're just out in Belgium. They absolutely loved you.
Yeah.
During that decade, how much pressure were you under to come up with the next hit?
So much pressure. You know, eventually it got to all of us, but for a long time, Ricky and Marty would be at home here in Hertfordshire songwriting, and I'd be off promoting. Mm. And because the success was worldwide, I didn't really stop. So I was living in a suitcase for pretty much the whole of the 80s of that decade. I didn't stop. And when you're 20-something, you've got all that energy and you don't have family and you don't have responsibilities and you're a pop star and it's great, you know. And, so I was just off, you know, traveling the world, singing Kids in America and various other hits that Rick and Marty came up. They were under immense pressure. I mean, it was a challenge. Sometimes it was overwhelming. But for the most part, we managed to keep our heads above water. And then in 88, we sort of did it again with You Came and the Close album and Never Trust a Stranger and Four Letter Word. And
so, your US number one was a cover, wasn't it? Keep Me Hanging On.
Yeah, and then Rick did an amazing, unique version of You Keep Me Hanging On.
Number one in America.
Yeah.
It's just the thing dreams are made of, isn't it? That would have been hard to believe, wouldn't it?
Well, it was. It was pretty amazing. But do you know what? I think I appreciate success more now than I did back then.
Yeah.
I had no, I was all a bit too young to really appreciate it.
Because you got kind of a midlife crisis at about 30, didn't you, when you first moved? Was it when you first moved into a house up here?
Well, it was, because I was here on my own. I always thought by the time I was 30, I'd be married and, you know, I'd have kids and stuff and move into a home with someone else. And I found myself moving into a lovely old 400-year-old barn, but on my own. And ultimately, a big old barn on your own is a bit daunting when you're 30 years old. And it was an incredible... It's an incredible house to live in. I still live there. And I knew how lucky I was. And I felt so guilty about feeling so bad. But I was lonely and I was, in many ways, the seeds for getting out of the industry were sown when I moved back to Hertfordshire. I knew that life couldn't continue the way it had throughout the 80s. I knew something else had to happen. And I knew that something else was getting out of the business. But that haunted me because I thought, well, what does an unemployed pop star do? What am I going to do? I can't even type. Don't even know how to type. Can't be useful anywhere. I remember saying it to my best mate, Claire, what am I going to do? I can't do anything. And, but I followed my passion, which had become gardening at that point. And the rest is history.
You did a bit of TV presenting as well.
I did. I kind of got roped into that, really. It wasn't something I was in search of. They found me at Capel Manor. They went looking for designers at Capel Manor.
Right.
And they name dropped furiously. They said, don't you know who's been here? And so I had them knocking on my door and I said to them, I'm not ready for this. I've only just started learning. They said, you'll be fine. We'll give you all the support. You'll be great. And I suppose I was. I was great in the way that I think I enabled a lot of people who thought they couldn't garden.
Yeah.
If Kim Wilde can do it, she can do it. I could certainly have a go. So if I did nothing but that, then I think I did a good thing.
So you look back now at the things you've done in your 37-year career. By the way, you'll be what, 58 in November?
It's all happening.
Does that frighten you?
No.
Okay. No, it was just a number?
Just a number.
When you look back, what is the highlight?
Of my life, I think meeting my husband, having a family. Yeah.
That tops meeting Michael Jackson and opening for him on a world tour.
Oh, yeah.
And David Bowie.
Yeah, yeah. It's close, that one, but yeah. It's close. Close, close, close. Yeah, no, I mean, having a family. I mean, a lot of people in this industry don't manage to have that and want it. And I'm very blessed. I've got two great kids, two fabulous dogs. I live in the best county in the UK, and happy days.
Anyone listening right now that's thinking about making their way in show business, one piece of advice you'd have for them?
Follow your passion. If your passion is music, follow it. It'll always take you to a good place. It'll never let you down. That's what I would say. It might take you to an unexpected place. It might not take you to the place you want to go, but it'll always take you to a great place.
The new tour, it's your first UK tour in 30, because I know there's a European leg after that, but it's your first UK tour.
Yeah, and let me tell you also,
in 30 years, yeah,
we've got Lawrence Hill coming with us.
Lawrence!
So we have a Hertfordshire boy on our tour. It's pure Hertfordshire.
You probably saw him on TV. He was in that, he was in The Voice. Yeah, yep. He's in The Voice. He did well on that.
He did. He got stitched up a bit.
I think so.
I don't much care for The Voice at all. I think it was disgraceful. Anyway, moving on. I think, Lawrence Hill has been writing some great new songs, and he's going to be showcasing them on the tour with me up and down the country, and he'll be our support.
Tell us about your
special guest, rather.
Tell us about the show, then. If someone comes to see Kim Wilde on this new tour, a lot of the dates are actually, a lot are sold out. A lot of people are going to miss out. But the ones that are lucky enough to get tickets, if there are still some available, wherever they see you in the UK, what are they going to see from Kim Wilde this time round?
Okay, well, don't expect to come and get too cozy, okay? We've got two drummers, and they make a lot of noise. So that's that for starters. We're going to sandwich our old hits in between some selected tracks from the new album, Here Come the Aliens. My niece is going to be there, the one who's created all this beautiful artwork for the project. Ricky Wilde obviously is going to be there. There's eight of us on stage. The alien theme, I can't pretend we're not embracing the alien theme. And for the first time, I've enlisted a costume designer for me, which is really good fun, because I've never really gone down that costume route. I've always just like put on the black jeans and the leather jacket and got on with things. But I decided that with an album called Here Come the Aliens, that would be churlish of me to throw away the opportunity to go a bit theatrical on this. So yeah, I have a selection of I think they'll put a smile on people's faces. I wouldn't call them sexy exactly. They're kind of more like Lara Croft meets Transformers meets my son's Transformer. Actually, it looks very like a robot he had in his garden.
So this is a long way from the stripy t-shirt and the black jacket then.
Yeah, this isn't stripy t-shirts. This is a bit robotic and a little bit like my kids' toys that I remember. Anyway, we're going to have fun with silver, and it's going to be lots of Swarovski crystals. I'm going to glow. I'm on fire. Oh, please. I just hope those aliens don't get really excited and take me away. I just really hope they don't come and take me away.
Fantastic. All the best with the new album, Here Come the Aliens, and the tour. Kim Wilde.
Hey, thanks, Graham.
My next guest was also inspired by aliens. 40 years ago, Jeff Wayne put out a concept double album based on H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds. And Jeff, ever since then, do you have to keep apologizing to people who you scared when they were kids?
Well, Graham, that's a good question, because when I first saw the War of the Worlds released, and it took off, you know, not just here in the UK, but around the world, is probably the question that you've just asked that started right from the get-go. And I was sort of very happy, in a way, to hear it was having such a reaction, because so many people just usually, or to start with anyway, young guys who were maybe in their teens or above, but would turn off all the lights in their house and even climb under their bed deliberately to get scared by it. And I was baffled, because I was thinking, well, I've just composed and produced, you know, a musical work based upon a brilliant and first science fiction story ever written, but it's appearing on a piece of plastic. So no matter how good the recording may have been, I still couldn't get my head around the fact that it's a record. It's not like a TV or a radio report that's talking about something that's actually happening.
Uh-huh.
But I've, over a period of time, I've sort of gotten used to the fact that it's had that impact, and I'm very, very proud of that in a way, because I had no idea it was going to really resonate like that.
So what did you think it would do?
Well, what I hoped it would do was entertain people from a musical point of view. The story is what I fell in love with. I felt was incredible, and it's lasted, you know, here I am now talking to you 40 years after my double album was first released. So I just wanted to entertain people, satisfy myself as a composer, arranger, and a producer without question, because it had been the first time in my career that I had the chance to just start with a blank page, so to speak, and whatever came out of me came out. So I guess it had a few different things that it achieved when I finally completed it, saw it come out, and become popular.
And what was the inspiration for you? Because there's been a couple of movies made of it. There's obviously the H.G. Wells book. Where did it start for you?
It began with my father, in fact, who about a year before I read The War of the Worlds, he kept reminding me that within my own aspirations as a composer, a producer, was to find a story or two in my career that I just felt very passionate about and would create something along the lines of a musical work as The War of the Worlds came out. And I agreed with him because I was doing a lot of producing, arranging, commissions from TV, commercials, movies, but I hadn't really been composing big projects that I was starting out from my own starting point. And it was something I wanted to do, so we agreed to just start reading books, not even science fiction per se. And it took about a year to find The War of the Worlds, and the way it actually happened was that during that period, I was producing, arranging, and then going out on tour with David Essex, who was really popular, and we were enjoying a great run together. And I would MD his bands, play keyboards on stage within the band, and do all the arrangements. And it was during that period, a tour came up, and my dad came over to wish me well for it, literally the night before I was going out on the road with David, and then handed me yet another book, and that book was H.G. Wells's The War of the Worlds, which I really didn't know very much about.
Yeah.
But after a year of sort of reading all sorts of books, this one just grabbed me, and I read it while we were on the road. It was no computers, no, you know, internet in those days, but this one as a book comforted me while I was on the road, and it just grabbed me from the very start on one read, and that was the beginning of it. So that was sort of around 1975.
So let's go back to the beginning then. You grew up in the United States. Where?
I was born in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And as a little boy, my parents and myself, we moved to England because my dad was a singer and an actor, and he secured the lead in a Broadway musical that was now coming to London, called Guys and Dolls, and he played the original romantic gambler of Skye Masterson. And that was the first occasion that I came to England, and it turned out we stayed for about 4 years because my dad kept getting all sorts of other work, from recordings, other stage productions, a couple films, TV work, and then we returned to New York again for about 4 years.
So what age were you at this stage, Jeff?
I was about eight,
mm-hmm.
something like that. After going back to New York, and I started high school there, we then moved to California for about 6 years because my dad started getting film, TV work. He kept his recordings going. And then he decided he wanted to start writing and producing more, and came back to England to produce, as he did, a few different shows. One of them turned out to be a a musical for the West End that ran at the Palace Theatre where Harry Potter's running now, many other shows before it. I had no real major CV at that time. My musical career in California was just at an embryonic stage. But my dad and I had actually written a few songs together, and he believed that I was the right composer to come over or come back to England and compose the score. I think the truth of it was pure nepotism. You know, a producer producing a major West End show, you know, would have the pick of almost all the top composers who had experience in writing musicals, but he stuck by me. I kept saying to him, "Are you sure? You know, I could totally understand if you want to go for anybody else." And he said, "Nope, I think this is going to work." And
what age were you by now?
About by the time he came back, I was about 16, 17,
wow,
something like that.
That's quite a break.
Well, it was. I mean, it was about another year or two before I finally came back to England, because he was still setting up the production and all the things that you do, you know, to really get anything going. And I spent 6 years in California going through high school and college, and my degree in college was, in fact, not in music, but it was in journalism. That's where I was heading, and music was going to be what I did for fun. But I got halfway through with an AA. Oh, I got an AA degree, which is a 2-year course. And instead of staying on for another 2 years and converting it into a master's degree, I switched over to music, because that was the point that I realized that music was the direction I wanted to go professionally. And so I didn't get the degree, because it was about a year and a half after starting with a music course. My dad confirmed, come back to England, let's get going for Two Cities, as it was called. It was based on Charles Dickens' A Tale of Two Cities.
And what were the major differences you found moving to England as a young man? What did you have to adapt to?
Well, I guess it wasn't a big jump on that second occasion, because I'd spent 4 years here.
Yeah.
As a young boy, and I became very familiar with the way of life, and there were differences. I think the thing that I remember most as a difference was the education I had up to that point, and then arriving in England and eventually sitting for my 11-plus exams, which I don't think exist anymore.
That's right, yeah.
And it was a tough journey in that respect, because I wasn't familiar with European history. I was really somewhat knowledgeable about American history and other courses that were slightly different to a lot of difference, actually. I had no French experience in being taught it, whereas it was one of the first classes I took when I first moved over. So those things impacted a lot more than making friends, which I made a lot of, and all the other things when you settle into a new home. But it was the education that really took a while for me to settle down in. And as a result, I didn't do well on the 11-plus.
Right.
And I wound up at a school called Haverstock.
Because the 11-plus, for those who don't know, if you passed it, you went to a grammar school, a well-respected school. If not, you went to a lesser school. So that's what happened to you.
Yes, exactly. It was Haverstock Hill, which still is there. But it was a very... In that period of time, it was still, in terms of its architecture and its whole development, very Victorian. I even remember if you wanted to go to the loo, you had to go out of whatever building you were in, and they were outside loos. Whereas several years ago, I went back and was asked to speak as somebody who had lived in London and actually went to Haverstock, and tell my experiences and then what happened to me after I left. And it was unbelievable, the difference. It had been something like £20 million of investment had been put into Haverstock, and now when you pass it just looks like a very modern major school. And it was exciting to go back and to talk to what I was asked to do is to talk to the mostly students who were specializing in music and the arts.
Right. And they had indoor plumbing as well, as a bonus by that stage, too. Yeah.
Well, for us, in the days that I went there, everything was off campus, so to speak. And I remember having to walk up Haverstock Hill to get to a gym or to a pool. It was a different environment completely.
Yeah. So you eventually, after the musical then, you earned your living as a composer in London.
Yes, well, actually, what happened, Graham, was that one of the investors in Two Cities that invested in the show invested because he liked the score, which by that time my dad and I had written. My father wrote the lyrics, by the way, and I composed all the music and orchestrated all the dance music. And so he liked it. That's one of the reasons he invested into it. And he was, in his day, during that period, a very successful director of TV and cinema commercials, and he asked me if I'd like to compose the music for a new campaign for, at the time, the largest advertising agency in the world, J. Walter Thompson.
Uh-huh.
And it was for the cheese board. I remember this very vividly, and my fee was 200 guineas.
Right.
After that, it's all a bit hazy. But that is actually how I carried on in England, and got more and more commissions as I made myself known, and the musical ran, and there was no desire or reason for me to go back to California professionally. So really, that's where it kicked off for me, and it's never changed.
Give us a little tip that we can use it maybe in a pub trivia quiz for some of the more famous jingles we might remember from the past that you wrote, that we can say, you know, Jeff Wayne, War of the Worlds, wrote that one?
Gosh, you know, I have to tell you, by the time I pretty much stopped doing music for advertising, it's only because my career had gone off in different directions, not just the War of the Worlds, but some other things.
Uh-huh.
But I had composed and produced, including some TV and radio themes, a few film scores, but over 3,000 productions.
Wow.
In a 10-year period. Yeah, it was quite extraordinary. So I think one that I could ask, and you tell me if you like the idea, is probably the most known song in the War of the Worlds is called Forever Autumn.
Yeah, Justin Hayward, yeah.
And that's right. And it started off life as a TV commercial.
Did it really? What for?
Well, it was for Lego toys.
Really?
Yeah, and I still actually have a copy of the actual commercial. But what you would hear is the two guys that actually wound up writing the lyrics for what became Forever Autumn, but they were also session singers and also sung in bands, and they were already very much involved in the music scene. And we met, and they started doing tons of vocals for me of all different styles for advertising and some film work. And if you were to hear the original Lego, there was no words, but what I asked them to do is I wrote this tune, which became the first verse of the song of Forever Autumn. And they just went, it was very Simon and Garfunkel-like as an arrangement that I did.
Uh-huh.
And they were just going do 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 do, etc. So you got through one verse, but then the public, when the commercials started being aired, there was a large response from the general public saying, "Is this a record? It was just very well liked."
Yeah.
And about that same point, Paul Vigras and Gary Osborne, who were the two singers that I was mentioning, they wrote the lyrics for what became Forever Autumn as part of a debut album that I produced and wrote all the music for, did the arrangements, and the album came out on MCA Records in America and then internationally. And the beginning of the life of Forever Autumn began on their debut album, and it came out as a single in Japan. And got to, it was either number two or number three, and they toured there. And but you'd have to know that history to know how Forever Autumn really began, because by the time I was composing the score for the War of the Worlds, and Forever Autumn was sort of inserted into the score. It was the only piece that I didn't compose originally for the War of the Worlds.
Right. And everything else you did from scratch, yeah.
Yeah, and I had no desire to include Forever Autumn, but I kept coming to a point in the story where our leading character, the journalist, is getting from Horsell Common in Surrey, trying to sort of rescue his fiancée and her father, who are living in London, from the invading Martians. And he arrives at their house to discover that she's not there. And that became, because you're not here, it became the sort of hook line of the song. And I couldn't compose anything other than coming back to the War of the Worlds. I kept rejecting everything I wrote. Gary Osborne and Paul wrote, and Paul Vigras wrote the lyrics as a full song, slightly amending the lyrics to their version. And I sort of raised the white flag to the Martians and said, okay, Forever Autumn's in.
It had to be in. And so how did you hook up with Justin Hayward then from Moody Blues?
Well, it was very similar to all the other guest artists. It was either knowing them as with David Essex and Julie Covington, I had already been working with them a lot in different ways. With Justin, Phil Lynott, Chris Thompson, I didn't know them. I knew of them, but I didn't know them, and I found a way to be introduced to them, and I wrote to Justin and sent him a little tape cassette that had what was both Forever Autumn and the demos for the main theme called The Eve of the War, which has a hook. The chances of anything coming from Mars are a million to one. And that was the two songs that that his role, which was the voice, the sung thoughts of the journalist. So instead of Richard Burton bursting into song, it went over to a musical character who became the sung thoughts of the journalist. And Justin loved it. He particularly loved Forever Autumn. And he came to the studio to have a listen, because every tune that had singing on it, I didn't presume, even with David and Julie, who I could call up as mates by that point, and say, would you like to appear on this musical work I'm composing and come in the sessions tomorrow or next week, and there's nothing to play him. So I demoed everything, and it convinced pretty much everybody who came in. There were a couple that came in that didn't think it was quite right for them.
Really? But, big names?
Yeah, or a couple that tried something out, and Paul Rogers, who was then in...
He'd been in Free, and he was in Bad Company at
that's
the time,
right.
I think.
And during that period, he actually came in to play the role of Parson Nathaniel, the part that Phil Lynott wound up playing. And spent a day with him, and his voice sounded amazing, as it was and still is. And then he was going to come back something like the next day or day after to do all what was the acting sessions that were interactions with the journalist, Richard Burton, and the parson's wife, which was played by Julie Covington. And something jittered him. He felt very comfortable doing all the singing, but I guess, as I learned from his manager, Peter Grant, that acting wasn't his thing, and the more he thought about walking into the studio and acting, particularly with Richard Burton, just sort of got to the point where he felt he couldn't come back in and complete the work. What he didn't quite get, or still didn't want to change his view about, was that Richard and Julie were already recorded.
Right.
And they didn't appear together in the same studio just because of availabilities, and Richard was, you know, we recorded Richard, or mostly most of all this, the material with him in California. So Paul Rogers would have been coming back into the same studio he spent the day at doing the singing parts, and he wouldn't have been sitting opposite Richard and Julie in, you know, doing an acting scene together.
So he missed out big time, didn't he?
Well, you know, some things are meant to happen, and I was very fortunate to then have been introduced to Phil. And the way I hoped that would interest him was that I had actually been a Thin Lizzy fan and knew a song that Phil started out talking. It was called Fool's Gold. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't a lot of it. It was maybe 15 seconds, 20 seconds, something like that. But it was very dramatic. And in addition to his singing style, which was amazing, I thought, gosh, maybe he'd like to play the role of Parson Nathaniel, who's a man who actually goes totally bonkers. He thinks the Martians are the devil.
Yeah.
And he loses all hope and faith. And there, as a man of the cloth, you would think is the person you'd go to for spiritual and moral comfort in your local community. And he's the first one that completely loses it. And his wife, named Beth, which was the role that Julie played, they did a very long piece called The Spirit of Man, which is essentially a duet where they go back and forth, where he's lost it and has no faith, and his wife is trying to keep him from going completely mad, because she does believe that life has value and that there's always something worth living for. And as I mentioned a couple minutes ago, everybody who was interested came in to have a listen, and in this instance, Phil came in and loved it immediately, and with his management, we struck a deal very, very quickly, and he started the sessions pretty soon thereafter, but unfortunately, he got a terrible case of flu, and if one was to hear the very original takes, you'd hear it in the voice, so we said, let's start again. The only problem was that he was going to, I think it was America and Canada, for about 3 months to do a tour. So we waited, because there was no question I wanted him to stay on board, and he wanted to do the same, so we waited, and it turned out brilliant.
Good stuff. Now, you mentioned Richard Burton, and in 1978, well, by 1978, Richard Burton had quite a reputation as a hellraiser. First of all, I mean, I don't think you could have picked a better voice or a better actor to do it, obviously until Liam Neeson many, many years later, but... Richard Burton, how easy or difficult was he to work with?
Well, you're absolutely right, Graham, that he came with a reputation.
Mm-hmm.
He was such a famous person that everything that he did, he got covered in the media, the press, and as a result, even though it was a very easy, when I say task, to enter into an agreement with him, the first thing was that he wanted to actually do it. I didn't pick him. He sort of picked me.
Really?
Well, what I mean by that is when I finished composing the first draft of my score, my stepmom, a lady named Doreen, who was from Hull originally, then raised with her family in Manchester, then came to London, and she was an author of books. She did some journalism, and she adapted the H.G. Wells novel based upon all sorts of notes and ideas that I was doing within the musical score. We finished about the same time our first drafts, and by that point we had the names of and the characters of all the leading roles that would appear on what became my musical version. And the role of the journalist is the only complete acting role.
Yeah.
No singing, all acting. When we only had a list, when I say a list, it wasn't, I'm not even sure you'd call it a list. There's maybe two or three other names beside Richard, but his was right at the very top because of the quality of his voice. It's like a musical instrument, in my opinion, and his acting skills, of course. And the opening piece particularly, I wanted the listener to hopefully be drawn into our world of the War of the Worlds, and to have a voice of the stature of Richard Burton was sort of the best piece of good fortune that started the casting, so to speak, of my double album.
Yeah.
But how do you get to somebody if you don't know them? And it's always the same process. You hope to know somebody who knows somebody who knows somebody, or you find out who their agent or manager is, and eventually you get to a point where you find out of that person's interest. But where we really had the sort of rub of the green, so to speak, was that as this was going on, we had some friends who had just come back from New York on a holiday, and they came over for dinner just to catch up, and we're sitting around, and they said, oh yeah, we had this great time in New York, and we saw a play called Equus, brilliant, starring Richard Burton. And suddenly my radar goes up, and I'm thinking, gosh, if Richard Burton is appearing in New York in a play. He's probably doing, you know, 8 shows a week. And I found out eventually what theater he was at through these friends. And again, you know, no internet, no Google in those days. So I just, with a postage stamp and an envelope big enough to hold the first draft of the script and a letter that I wrote introducing myself and saying I'm a composer, producer, working on a musical interpretation of H.G. Wells's The War of the Worlds. The first draft of our script is enclosed, and I wonder if you'd like to consider playing the role of the journalist. And what I decided to do at that point was not to try to send it to a manager if he had one. I knew by then the name of the theater, and I sent it to the stage door, hoping that on one of the show days that he would come in, the man at the stage door would hand him my little care package, which is exactly what happened. And, you know, did I know that I'd even get a response? No. But it couldn't have been more than 3 or 4 days after my package arrived that I received a call from a man named Robert Lance, based in New York, who was Richard's manager of that time. And he called me at my home, and I was in a meeting with my dad and Doreen about something to do with the War of the Worlds, and I picked up the phone, and it was Robert Lance on behalf of Richard Burton saying, Richard's received your package, he's read it all, and he loves the idea, and the following words, which I will never forget, were from him, were, count him in, dear boy. I handed the phone sort of in shock to my dad, and between him and Mr. Lance, they struck a deal over the phone.
Wow.
Which got turned into a contract, but it's held up to this day, and his last wife, Sally, inherited everything from him, so we still have contact. When we performed The War of the Worlds in Australia and New Zealand, she came to one of our shows in Australia. But as to the precise question of what was it like to work with somebody with such a reputation,
yeah.
Well, all I can say is that wasn't the Richard Burton I worked with or got to know thereafter. He was the most charming and well-prepared performer I've ever worked with, and he was so enthusiastic about it. We even have outtakes of things that when he stumbled on something or did a take that we were, say, happy with, he'd say, no, look, I think I can do it again better. These are delicious words.
Yeah.
And comments like that. Yeah, and we've got them on our outtakes, and it's lovely to think back about a man that I started knowing through a reputation and turned out to be quite a different bloke.
So there wasn't the slightest sign of him being awkward, difficult, you know, finding the bottle, anything like that at all?
Not at all. I can't explain it any other way because it's just not the Richard Burton I got to know. Maybe it was the time in his life where he decided to straighten himself out. And it didn't just, it wasn't that I noticed this just on the session, because contractually we had the right to work with Richard for 5 studio days of up to 10 hours a day.
Yeah.
We went to California to stay on our schedule. We had to go to California because by the time it was all agreed, he had left Equus in New York and gone to Los Angeles to make a movie.
Yeah.
So we agreed to go to L.A., the whole production team, and we recorded him. And, you know, when I was saying a minute or two ago how well-prepared he was, to give you an idea, we had something like 150 sequences that the role of the journalist was to record, and he did it all in one, not even long day.
Oh, wow.
And, that just gives you an idea of the standard of his work, the way that he took the direction, and in such a nice way. We did have to, because the first assembly of The War of the Worlds was about 2 hours in length, and particularly in the era of the black vinyl disc where even 4 sides, you know, there was a maximum amount of time that you could fit sound on before it all started to lose the bass end and just didn't sound very good. So I did an editing of that first assembly, and it came down from 2 minutes to something like 95, 100 minutes, which is what eventually came out. And Richard as a result, had to come back and do some repair work that wasn't really anything to do with the standard of what he did. It was simply because I made cuts to sort of all the elements, not just the script, but some of the music material, to get it down. And he came back now in London, for it was something like 2 to 3 hours, and that was him done. But after the War of the Worlds came out, we actually stayed in touch, and he asked me to compose the score for a TV special that he had signed to do for one of the American networks. And it was to be, from his point of view, reading selected works of Dylan Thomas, who he was a good friend with.
Yeah.
And then visually there were going to be interpretations as he was performing whatever the piece was. And he asked me to compose the score. And jump forward to 1984, because the album came out in 1978, so that gives you a span of time that we did stay in touch on and off. We met in London, spent the day together to talk about this TV production, and he had agreed also to become a talking head on what would have been my first tour of the War of the Worlds, more concert-like rather than multimedia as it has become.
Yeah. So up until that stage, it had never been toured live?
No, never.
Right.
I had guest conducted a couple of pieces from the War of the Worlds with orchestras and other lineups, but no. And I had been asked fairly, when I say regularly, on and off over a period of those years to take a tour on the road. But, and again, limitations of technology in those days. It was more concert, but with this talking head.
Yeah.
And Richard agreed immediately. So we met in 1984. He just finished a movie called 1984.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the day, he said, right, well, me and Sally, his last wife, we're going on holiday to Switzerland. He said, we're coming back in a fortnight, and we can get together again to firm up when we're going to do the talking head, because I had taken him on that day to the studios in London that had the technology, how to make talking heads.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll firm up, actually, the recording session dates for the TV special. Great. I couldn't, be more thrilled to be working with him again.
Yeah.
Not just on the War of the Worlds now, but a second project. And a week later, he died in Switzerland.
Yeah.
And my wife and I, we wound up at his memorial service in called St. Martin's in the Field in London, just by Trafalgar Square, and it was quite surreal, to be honest. And all his family and other wives, and just the whole thing was extraordinary. But and in a way, that was in 1980. That was the summer of 1984, around August. I then stopped the idea of taking this tour, and without Richard's performance, and I went on to another project, and just wanted to get my head clear of Martians and come back to it on another day.
Well, for the 40th anniversary, I know that the double album as a vinyl album has been re-released, and it's done quite well, because vinyl, there's a real resurgence of the format. This new tour, tell me a little bit about this. These arena shows, what's this going to be like, and who's in it?
Right. Well, we started arena touring in 2006,
mm-hmm.
and it included a talking head of Richard Burton, which we didn't have the benefit of Richard because of the years past when he passed away. But we had film and particularly two still images of him that were perfect for the age that the journalist was meant to be.
Mm-hmm.
And with technology that was now available, we could recreate him with what became something like a 25-foot tall, 9-10 feet wide talking head. And he hovered above the stage while the rest of the production, all live, went on in front of the audiences. And in 2006, it was already quite a mega multimedia production.
Mm-hmm.
But each tour we've done, and we've done a lot now, it keeps growing. Just in stuff, to give you an idea, Graham, we were a 6-truck tour in 2006, and this coming year, we're up to 12.
Doubled it.
Yeah, bloody expensive.
I bet, yeah, yeah.
In fact, truthfully, in today's world, You're only limited by your imagination and your pocketbook.
Right.
And every tour, we have grown it, and this tour is no different. We have a couple of amazing new ingredients that will bring the production more into the audience while it's still going on the stage, above the stage.
Can you say what these ingredients are?
Sure. Well, first of all, we brought four giant screens into the audience on different angles. We've always had one big screen that goes in the back, about 100 feet wide and 20, 25 feet tall. But these are four now that are in the audience for creative reasons, to be able to see and do things in the editing that we could never do previously. It also, and I've always been aware of it, when I've gone to concerts or shows, in particularly, you know, the big arenas, where the further back you sit, the less involved you feel you are.
Yeah.
And I've wanted to, on this production particularly, give more personal contact with the show, the artists that are in them. So that's one of the new ingredients. But we also have a physical new ingredient that is an extension of, it's a piece that the artilleryman, who performs well into the second act, and he's got he's not super intelligent, but he's got this vision of how man can survive while the Martians are now dominating the Earth, and that's to take the best of those who have survived underground and to rebuild A Brave New World, which is the name of the piece.
Mm-hmm.
Up till this tour, a large part of it is performed on a bridge in the shape of sort of like an arc. And it's impressive, and it has always been impressive, no matter how much we've dressed it up and extended it over the years. It's on stage, whereas this production, it's grown in size, and it comes down, connects with the stage, but is even a bigger arc, and it's over the audience, sort of central to the stage. And he performs Brave New World not only on top of this bridge, but also there's a performance area further along into the audience. And to give you an idea of the scale of it, if you were to take two of the biggest arenas in Great Britain that we play, Manchester and the O2, this bridge from the stage extends about 50% over the entire audience.
Wow, that's quite a span.
Yeah, the scale is something. But as we go into the smaller arenas, and small isn't small in that world, you know, the smallest arenas are 4,000 or 5,000 seaters and everything in between that and the two biggest. And so by the time you get to the smaller arenas, this bridge is virtually the length of the whole downstairs section. Pretty much touches our front of house desk and where all the sound is mixed from. So it's bringing the show to the audience. It's exciting, and no matter where you sit, you'll see it from a different way than if you're sitting and looking at this bridge come down on the stage. So physically, those are two of the biggest new ingredients. But there's a whole bunch more. There's some new musical contents. So it's advanced yet again.
And the performers in it this time on this tour?
Right. Well, Liam is still returning. He travels with us in a little hard disk.
Yeah.
He's never late. He never misses a cue.
Yeah.
And the rest of the cast are mostly new to the War of the Worlds, with the exception of Jason Donovan, who comes back as Parson Nathaniel. This is his fourth tour with us. He started as an artilleryman and then found God and became Parson Nathaniel.
Okay.
He's great fun to work with. He's such a talented man, and I always look forward to working with Jason. Returning with Jason for her second time is a singer-actress, Carrie Hope Fletcher, who's become very popular, starting with playing Eponine in the West End production of Les Mis.
Uh-huh.
She's done other productions. She's written a couple of books, and a most glorious voice and a lovely lady with it. So those are our two returning members. We now have, as the Sung Thoughts of the Journalist, having had Justin Hayward for a number of our tours, and then Marty Pello, and now it's Newton Faulkner, who has quite an amazing voice, and the look about him is perfect. And everybody, by the way, has come in already and tried out everything they have to do, so they're comfortable with the material, and we too feel the same, and then we go forward with a contract, so to speak. So Newton, he plays the sung thoughts of the journalist. Then we have Nathan James, who has one of the biggest rock voices I've ever heard. He's the lead singer for a group called Inglourious, and he's the voice of humanity, the person who's representing, witnessing the final battle between man and Martian at the end of the first half of the show. And the song is called Thunderchild, and it's about this final battle where, after it, man has been defeated. So it's Martians 1, humanity 0 after the first half, and then the story unfolds after that. And all the guest artists now, they appear in multiple pieces, which is not how it started all those years ago. And then as the artilleryman, we have Adam Garcia, who he's been in many different things. He's a singer, an actor, a great dancer. He's been in a movie called Coyote Ugly. He had the leading role in that. He opened the Olympic Games in Australia with Kylie Minogue, and they performed. He's just played a dramatic role in the West End called The Exorcist. He was a judge, because he's a brilliant dancer, on the TV series, which I think has now ended, called You Can Dance. So when you look at Adam's career, it's really a sort of a patchwork quilt of many top things. So he's our artilleryman. And then I'm up on stage conducting again. The Ula Dabula Strings and the Black Smoke Band. And it's mostly musicians that have started with me as far back as 2006. And even two of the band members, Herbie Flowers and Chris Spedding, were on my original double album.
Chris Spedding, the guitar player.
Yeah.
Very famous session player. Yeah, had a hit with motorbiking, but Spedding's so well-respected as a guitar player.
Oh, yeah. When you, and Herbie, if you look at their CVs of who they've played live with or recorded with, it's quite something. It's very few musicians who I think would have the length and breadth and quality of CVs that they have, and they're just as enthusiastic today performing it live. They've never missed an arena production with me. We actually did a season, something like 88 shows in the West End in 2016 at the Dominion Theater, and Chris was even in that, so we go back a long way.
Yeah, and Anna Marie Wayne?
Anna Marie is my daughter.
Yes, that's why I mentioned that.
She has been an actress since around the age of 13, starting in, mostly in TV. Then she moved with what then was her husband to California. She's for about 6 years and did quite a bit of work there. And when we started in 2006, she became the fiance of the journalist. But it was literally two lines that were filmed. We felt it a bit, couldn't quite afford her to travel around to say two lines.
Yeah.
But the role, out of the way that the production has grown, is now become one of the largest roles, sort of equal to anybody else. And providing she can work her way through having three children, and how will she, you know, tour with us live, she's going to do it live. And if not, it's we have a B plan, which is a filmed role, but with these new screens and the 3D elements, it's not far off as if she was going to be there. So one way or another, she's involved again.
It just sounds like a terrific show. How, over the years, over the 40 years, how has your relationship with the work changed?
It's endured me completely, Graham, because what I fell in love with all those years ago was a very dark Victorian tale. And it's sort of three key themes are invasion, faith, and hope. And nothing has changed. The world is no different. You know, we look at the world we live in, but I'd like to think that one walks away from either listening or seeing the show feeling more hopeful than than fearing the world. And nothing has changed. What I've definitely seen is that once I started touring, I could get a much better impression from how audiences from a live production were responding, and it gave me the motivation to go back and listen to those 150 takes or so of Richard's original recording, because of the length of the production, mm-hmm. the length of the double album, particularly the double album, what the audiences heard or heard and saw in the first six or so productions, arena tours, was about 74 of those 150 sequences that Richard recorded.
Mm-hmm.
So the reason that Liam Neeson and the show became known as The New Generation was because I went back to that script with Richard and said, you know, there's a lot of rich material, no pun intended there, that never has been heard. And it's got good value, so we set about sort of gluing it all back together, but writing some new stuff as well. And The New Generation now, with Liam, instead of 74 sequences, Liam alone has 91 sequences, which gives you an idea, when you add up all the other new material of The New Generation, how it's grown. And it's worked tremendously well. It's given me, as a musician, a chance to re-examine material that also either could be extended, or there was, in fact, one minor theme that appeared right through that point, starting with the recordings, that had a lot of emotion attached to it within the story, and I've turned it into a song called Life Begins Again, and it's sung by all the guest artists. Sort of, they do leads, counterlines, harmonies all together, and it appears in two places in the show, so that's an extension from what was a secondary theme. So there's been a lot of exciting material.
That's really good to know that you're not just showcasing 40-year-old work and sticking it on. The thing is evolving and improving all the time. It's a living thing.
Thank you. Yes, indeed. That's how I've always felt about it. From the value of the price of a ticket, I've never wanted anybody to think, oh, I'm just taking it out of the box and doing it the same way again. It'd be a lot easier and a lot more profitable.
Yeah.
But that's never been my dream about it. And yes, I refer to it as you've just done, as a living work in every respect.
Jeff Wayne, the musical version of the War of the Worlds 40th anniversary tour is something not to be missed. It's an honor to talk to you, Jeff. Thank you so much for your time.
Many thanks, Graham. Lovely to speak with you.
Well, that's it from me. Thanks for listening. If you've enjoyed London Calling, then keep up with what I'm up to at macmedia.co.uk. Ta-da!